The first few days in India were spent in the large, bustling city of Mumbai. The sound of honking tuk-tuks was a constant, a language between drivers that reverberated throughout the city. I was there to meet with scholarship recipients. They were sharing their stories of overcoming their bleeding disorders and chasing their dreams. There were doctors, finance executives, and other successful young men. But huddled into the common area of the hospital in the heart of a huge city, it was hard to imagine where their journey started. A few days later, I got to see it firsthand. We are now on the other side of the country in the beautiful state of Assam, driving through the countryside. Tea fields lined the sides of the road, and the honks of tuk-tuks were replaced by the sounds of wildlife. Instead of being dwarfed by skyscrapers, we were surrounded by palm trees. We finally pulled into the home of our scholarship recipient Kaushik. He lives in a simple compound with many of his family members. The homes are all the same pale gray color. They are made of mud from the area, which is incredibly common. The roofs are covered by some metal sheeting, and venting at the top allows a breeze to pass through. It's clear that these keep out most of the weather, but definitely not all of it. Each part of the family has a small room in the compound, but privacy doesn't really exist. Kaushik and his parents share a room, and there aren't any real windows. The light filters in through the open areas high on the walls. We sit down close to Kaushik's bed for the interview. He has a printout of the exercises he should be doing for physical therapy, books for his classes he is studying, and then I see something that looks wildly out of place in this rural setting. Boxes of medication stacked on the table next to his bed. It's Factor, and quite a bit of it. I was stunned. I knew that access to Factor has been improving around the world, but seeing a substantial amount in this small home was still shocking. We asked Kaushik about the medicine and came to learn that the state of Assam has been able to start buying Factor for patients with hemophilia there. He's been on low-dose prophylaxis, which has been life-changing. We've talked a lot on this podcast about the hidden complexities of healthcare around the world, the unseen elements that compound problems for patients around the world. But for people living with hemophilia, the impact of Factor is relatively straightforward. It helps. A lot. But for many places, resources are still scarce, despite the positive impact. So how was Assam, India able to get Factor? My name is Chris Bombardier, and I'm a mountaineer with hemophilia. From 2011 to 2018, I successfully climbed the seven summits, the tallest mountain on each of the seven continents. But when that journey was over, I realized my next adventure was just beginning. I soon began my advocacy work with Save One Life to bring help, compassion, and resources to the bleeding disorder community around the world. And most importantly, learn from them about the challenges they face and what we can do to educate and help. Global healthcare is full of its own peaks and valleys. And if there's anything I learned climbing the seven summits, it's that there's always another mountain to climb. This is the final summit, season two, The World After the Mountains.
This next segment is brought to you by Genentech. Living with a serious illness can come with many challenges. Getting Genentech medicines should not be one of them. The Genentech Patient Foundation gives free Genentech medicine to people in the United States who don't have insurance coverage or financial concerns. To learn more about this initiative and to find out if you're eligible, please visit www.genentechcommitment.com.
I have three brothers with hemophilia. They have hemophilia type B severe, which means they use factor 9. My name is Tirsa Cárcamo. I am a project leader for the Honduran Society of Hemophilia. I have been a volunteer for the last 7 years and strongly working in projects for the last five. My parents tell us that when they went to the doctor, so my first brother was born, they didn't know that he had hemophilia. So they thought it was cancer or something, and they were running tests and not getting to an accurate diagnosis of what he had. And then my second brother was born, and they finally get to a hematologist, they run tests, They say, one of the boys has hemophilia. Are there any other sons? They say, yes, we have another son. Bring him. The second one also has hemophilia. And so when my parents were asking about this condition, because they had never heard about it, the doctor says, sometimes they survive. So that was the prognosis for them. Sometimes they survive. I did not become a volunteer because I was super qualified or I had any special skills. It was just there was a meeting in the hospital in the city where I live, and they just needed someone to watch the table with the snacks. So they just needed someone to be there organizing the snacks and everything. And I was like, sure. I was like 17 or 16. And I was like, sure, I can be there. And that's how I started. And then I went to another meeting, and then I went to the General Assembly. And then I went away to college and became more involved. And so that's how it started.
That's wonderful. They got you hooked in a little bit. Start small and then they get you connected really tightly.
Yeah.
What's your favorite aspect of working with the society?
I think I'm a people person. So the best thing for me is working with people, seeing the patients. Because at first, the only people with hemophilia I knew were my brothers.
Yeah.
So you start connecting with more and they have similar experiences and it's, oh, did that happen to you? And they connect. And then you get to see that interaction. Then you talk to the moms and other sisters and wives and daughters. So the community, I think that's the best part for me.
I'd love to, if you could just share a little bit about your background and how you became such a big advocate for the bleeding disorder and hemophilia community specifically.
Thank you for this invitation. I am Cesar Garrido. I am the president of the World Federation of Hemophilia. At the beginning was just with the patient organization here in Venezuela, my country, Venezuela Association. And that gave me the opportunity to be a volunteer of the World Federation since the 1999, something like that. So I received the opportunity to be member of the board of the WFH in 2002. So I have been working almost 21, 22 years as volunteer of the WFH. In that aspect of leading advocacy as a patient organization, local, regional, and now global organization.
So you were working locally and then volunteering with WFH. So you've really seen the progress of bleeding disorder care around the world over several decades. What do you see as the biggest success in the community over those past few decades?
The progress has been really awesome because I remember when I started was in those moments that the panic about the contamination, infection with the HIV, hepatitis C, but never, I think someone thought that, for example, hemophilia, 7 years ago, the improvement that 7 years ago with different options, different alternative, the prophylaxis, for example, how to fight against the inhibitors, and no contamination, no one talk about contamination properly. It's something that really understood. So I think that that is part of the improvement. Maybe the more tangible example could be Africa experiences, because I have visited Africa. I remember Africa in 2005, 2010, even 2010.
Yeah.
No one thought that Africa have this kind of the therapy, prophylaxis, extend their life. No factor. So that is something that when you visit Africa recently, at least I had the opportunity to identify is possible. It is possible.
Yeah, I had the exact same experience. My first trip to Africa was in 2011. And then even when I went back in 2019, the level of care and the level of change in just those 8 years was drastic, seeing patients having prophylactic treatment, seeing younger kids without the joint damage that we saw the first trip. Obviously, there's still a long way to go, but the shift was monumental.
I visited Zambia last year, and this is very particular point and was emotional for me. I was excited because they set an event about the first workshop about comprehensive care team. So when you say that, you have to go back many years ago when we talk about just the concentrate, the use of the concentrate.
Yeah.
And the revolution later was comprehensive care team, even you have concentrates available.
Yeah.
So when this in Africa, Zambia, the government is thinking to purchase products, even our donation, they are thinking include in their budget medicines, and not any medicines, recombinant at least, extend their health life. So that is something, comprehensive care team, comprehensive care treatment, and at the same time, factors, the high purity, high security into the budget of the government in Africa, in Zambia, is something that stimulates you because, okay, maybe you don't have to wait 10 years else.
Yeah.
But it's just the light of, at the end of the tunnel. The success has been thanks to the advocacy properly based on scientific evidence.
When my brothers were little, back in the 90s, we rarely had access to factor concentrate, only if we traveled to the capital city, and then sometimes it was just a couple doses. Mm-hmm. So it was not a lot. It was mostly available for hemophilia type A patients, not so much for hemophilia type B. And so oftentimes what we had to do with was Creo. And that when it comes to quality, that's not the best option.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work as good in your body, and there's also a chance of risk.
Yeah.
Now, through years, over 30 years of consistent advocacy work with authorities of hospitals, with authorities of the general government, of the Ministry of Health, we now have more access to medication. Like just the last time that I went to the hospital, we got 30-something boxes, and the cost of that is over 100,000 lempiras. Hmm. So that is at 10 months of salary, of minimum salary.
Wow.
That is how expensive this is. And now we can actually have access to medication and keep it in our fridge. That did not happen before. Even if you are evaluated by the doctor and they consider it necessary, you can even have prophylaxis. We have patients in a special trial, hemophilia type A patients, that they are using longer lasting products. Mm-hmm. And we are just evaluating how that works in their bodies and if it's worth it for the government to invest in that. So if this back in the 90s, this was unimaginable. We could not think that we would have enough medicine to have in our fridge, that we could just go to the hospital and get it, or that we would even be testing new therapies.
Yeah.
So we've come a long way. And now 7 hospitals in the country are distributing factor, so which is impressive. It's getting closer to where you live.
Changing the world is daunting. And when you're looking to try to fix the whole forest, sometimes you forget that you can fix one tree. This entire podcast, we've talked about huge structural issues in the world of global health. Poverty, women's health, social stigmas, education. But in all of these, the first step is starting small. Finding something that you can help. And then watching the ripple effects that one small change can have on the whole ecosystem. In Assam, India, where I was visiting at the beginning of this episode, that factor was just the beginning. A small, but very important ripple that not only changed lives, but changed the government and the future ability to treat bleeding disorders and open up the world to a brighter future. It's easier to access because we fought for it. And fighting for one small step can open up the path to a healthier future. It's also a better way to prove that change is possible. When you advocate to change something small, it can be motivating to others. It can show them that change is possible. Changing the entire system doesn't just seem daunting. It can feel impossible. But changing what's within your reach not only feels doable, but can be the first domino to enact lasting change. As long as you keep going.
So as president of the WFH, I have to be successful with our strategy plan is until 2025. But it's important because even looks like small steps, but we have to increase 25% of the patient register that it will be. It would mean for, of course, diagnosis, more diagnosis, but at the same time, for me, it's more effective and more impactful that the countries and the hospitals, no matter where, they share the data, because that is one of the challenges. In many cases, for example, even Europe, more in Europe, the majority in Europe, they don't share by I don't know the reason properly.
Yeah.
But they don't share, they don't swap the information between them. So that the effect is we don't have to register.
Yeah.
You don't have to register. It's impossible to design the accurate and the right strategy. So that is something that I try to convince the people. The other one is to convince the people that everybody, even the patients and caregivers as well, that the prophylaxis is the therapy. No matter what product you are using, that is something that I have observed visiting several countries. We need more donation about this factor X or this factor Y. No, it's not the factor X, the factor Y. It's the prophylaxis according to the criteria of the hematology who is trying to look after you.
It will not be overnight. It may not even be next year, necessarily. It'll take consistent work, consistent presence, and a very solid patient organization in order to achieve that. It is possible, yes, because in any country in the world, the government manages millions, whether in national currency or US dollars or euros, they manage millions. So they have money. We just need to get them to understand the need and give us a portion of that.
Hopefully, if listeners have access to a mechanism by which their voice can be heard, right?
Once again, Carlos Guzman.
Then either through controller services or ombudsman services, right, that sometimes are in place in systems and nations in order to have voices be heard. But one of the questions I get asked a lot as well for my students is, what would you do? Where do I start? And I always tell them, there's probably already an organization working on some of the things that you're interested in. So creating a critical mass of people is better than having a lot of organizations acting solo, right? So we can create networks of organizations. We can definitely leverage the power of the many. But there is this moment where critical mass is reached, where then trigger points are reached and change can happen. So that's all movement building theory that I'm talking about. This is Marshall Gantz and other great scholars on this, that really, when you are a citizen and you're not in the political power, you're not an elected official, or you don't have the, let's say, the monetary power to influence like the billionaires of the world, the best thing you can do is actually either join a movement if there's one that you align with, or start your own and start building that critical mass of people. But usually there's something already happening, right? And I think organizations like yours are a good place to start. If you have a patient that needs a voice, that needs the access to these medications, by themselves, they might have very little impact. But in conjunction with other patients, their voice is elevated and then they can have more impact.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's also about consistency, right? It's not going to change overnight. It's about having that consistent voice and getting it in front of people consistently before it'll potentially make a change. And that's actually something we see in the US with the bleeding disorder community is we have had really good access to care for many years. Life expectancies are approaching near normal. And we see that people are becoming disengaged with the advocacy efforts, speaking with politicians and trying to continue to have our policy ideas and needs heard. So I think there's a aspect of, that continuity that of voice. And it's not something that you can ever stop advocating for because it could definitely go backwards as well.
In the middle of COVID, a transition of government, and we started coming closer to the person head of the health ministry now, but it was pretty much the results were not as desired. So we were getting a lot of no's and a lot of there's no budget, even though there's a new government and there's an expectation on the new government to deliver what is promised in the campaign. We were not getting that. However, we've been doing this for 30 plus years. It's not a time that we're going to back out, that we're going to desist. We're not going to wait until a new person comes into office, but we're going to keep pushing on this person. And for us, it's important that they see the result. So if they give us an opportunity, we're going to keep pushing for meetings, for a space, if not with the head, with the second person in charge or with the secretary or anyone that can give us their ear to hear what we come to say. And we're going to present our case, we're going to present the information, we're going to present the patients, the results of the difference that it makes in a person to go from an on-demand modem of treatment to having prophylaxis, for example. And so we come to them. We're not going to desist in our efforts, and we just keep on pushing. So far, the doors are opening a little bit. I think just in March or May, we were talking about this. We still had no results. Yeah. The doors are opening a little bit. We are having meetings, and they are beginning to listen. At least they're giving us the space to talk. So we don't have any offer, any strong offers yet from them, any strong results. But the doors are opening a little bit, and I think with the right pitch, the right information, I think we can go where we need to go. But we try to bring someone from the directive board that has been doing this for many years. We also bring a patient because we have to put a face to that condition. You know, it's not just numbers, not just in forms or reports. It's actually this person that is sitting here at the table right now. And they can see joint damage when they see the face of a patient, because rarely you will find them at the hospital or at the clinic. So sometimes we have to bring the patients and then have the patient tell them what the experience is like in the hospital, in the clinic, what medication does to them.
Yeah.
So they can see live.
We created this organization around 7 years ago here in Costa Rica in order to create what we imagine to be a platform for collaboration in order to transform health professional education, right? So we work at different levels with the organization, everything from the student level that is trying to deliver skills, mindsets, knowledge, value systems change into students that want to take part in our educational experiences. But we also work with faculty members around the world in the form of faculty workshops in order to provide them also with the tools necessary for them to do a work that is centered in empathy and centered in justice, centered in equity, centered in the reconnection with our natural environment, right? So Centro Interamericano para la Salud Global, its name in Spanish, is trying to create change at those different levels, but also trying to create frameworks in order to have institutional change. And we also participate through our different hats that we have in the conversations that are happening in global consortia level of universities and higher education in general, in order to be able to shift from the top down how education is set up, right? And basically health and global health and public health, professional education.
Well, I am optimistic. I have to recognize the WFH for me was to be president of this organization in several moments. I have to recognize it. I want to be honest with you. I was afraid to assume this responsibility because it's a great responsibility. But when I noticed that I never will be alone, I have a very staff, professional staff, outstanding staff supporting me, supporting other experts, supporting other volunteers, is possible to help. And my concern is to try to help the hemophilia community and other bleeding disorder faster than we have done. Yeah. We don't have to wait 10 years in order to be more successful. So it's possible to, and it's my intention, it's my own intention to try to speed out our reaction of World Federation of Hemophilia.
For the community in general, for the dream of access to treatment and integral medical attention, I dream that we have our own attention center for hemophilia. Like, we don't have to go to the general hospital because we go to the hospital that treats almost every serious condition in the country, the hospital that's in the capital city. But if we had our own hemophilia center, that would be so much easier because we know that we're going to have dentists already know, nurses already know.
Yeah.
Everyone would already know. Yeah. A hematologist available to us 24/7. And so that would be a dream because it is a condition in your genes. I am planning to have kids. So my kids, my nephews, I don't know if there would be in the coming generations more patients with hemophilia. So it is something that I do not want to desist or abandon that dream of having a hemophilia treatment center just for patients with hemophilia and other bleeding disorders. That would be. And for my brothers, they are doing very good thanks to the support of Save One Life, of the Society of Hemophilia. The doctors are great with them. They go to their doctor appointments. They are going to the dentist. And so I'd like them to be fully confident in who they are.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you choose not to say in some environments that you have a medical condition, and that is okay. But I would like them to be open about it and not have people asking strange questions or people thinking they would not be capable of doing certain things because of that. So I'd like them to be fully out there in a full potential, full capacity, without having to deal with misconceptions or obstacles.
Yeah.
Sometimes the answers are easy, and sometimes they're profoundly difficult. But the most important thing when facing any difficult situation is to not wait around hoping for change, but to act. Save One Life's mission has always been to help those with bleeding disorders around the world manage their condition and embrace the future. And we do it one small step at a time. It's in our name, inspired by the iconic line from Schindler's List, "He who saves one life saves the world." We focus on the doable, focusing on one problem at a time, and knowing that those small actions lead to ripples that can affect how the world handles and deals with hemophilia. Sometimes it's providing factor to areas that need it. Other times it's helping with grants and stipends for hospital visits and access to education. Other times it's simply listening, sitting down across from someone who has a story to tell, and hearing their problems, hearing their concerns, and letting them know they're not alone. It is advocacy, knowing there's a problem out there and working towards that without getting overwhelmed by the bigger picture. And our advocacy in India has made a profound difference. We no longer need to ship factor to India. Infrastructure is now in place, and market access has made it more widely available. So how can you help save the next life? Save One Life collects factor through our program Project Share. Patients that cannot use what they currently have at home because they have changed products or their dosage changed can send us their medication, and we will make sure it gets to the patients and families that need it. That doesn't mean you can just send us factor because you want to help. There has to be a legitimate reason the factor cannot be used. For more questions, please contact share@saveonelife.net for more information, or visit saveonelife.net and look for Project Share. Thank you for listening to the Final Summit Season 2. Time to find your next adventure and climb your next mountain.
The Final Summit is produced by Bloodstream Media. Learn more at bloodstreammedia.com. This episode is hosted by Chris Bombardier, written by Drew Johnson, edited by Greg Bernard, produced by Keith Corneluk, executive produced by Patrick James Lynch. The Final Summit was also made possible by support from Genentech. Visit genentechhemophilia.com to take a look at how they are supporting the hemophilia community.